The Symphony No. 1 by Alexandre Guillemont. Ian Tracy played the organ of Liverpool Cathedral, and Jan-Pascal Tourtellier conducted the BBC Philharmonic. Next week, I have music by Stanley Bate, Finzi, Howells, Messiaen, a gorgeous string quintet by Imogen Holst, and music by two of next Sunday's birthday composers, Frédéric Chopin and Thomas Adès. All that and more from 9 o'clock next Sunday with me, James Jolly. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions. And Michael Barclay's guest this week is the novelist Ben Okri.
Stories can conquer fear. They can make the heart bigger. So says my guest, the distinguished writer Ben Okri. Author of the Booker Prize-winning The Famished Road, he's written many other acclaimed novels. The latest, The Age of Magic, is just out, and he's also published collections of poetry, short stories and essays. A Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, Ben Okri has been awarded an OBE, as well as numerous international prizes, including the Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Africa and the Crystal Award from the World Economic Forum. So, Ben, I quoted you just then, stories can make the heart bigger. And you clearly believe in the power of stories and their vital place in human life.
Yes, I do. My life has been surrounded by stories, enriched by stories, and to some extent even emerges from stories. I grew up in a very great storytelling environment in Nigeria, in Africa. Stories are everywhere. Stories are in a leaf of a tree, stones on the bank of a river, the eyes of an old man. Stories seethe and bubble from everywhere. But writing stories is quite a different discipline and a different kind of magic.
Your work has been translated into more than 20 languages, and I suppose that also says something about the way stories transcend geographies and specific cultures.
Stories do. I think that the human mind is a story-producing faculty. The brain, if you like, left to itself, given the merest hint, rushes forward to create stories, to complete things. It's the way in which our mind relates to reality. We are urged forth constantly into meaning, and the form that meaning takes is a pattern which we perceive of our story. Stories are intrinsic to humanity.
That's very fascinating, given that you've chosen Wagner, who was a great storyteller, but one who tried to transcend the human. And in so doing, tell us something about ourselves, I think.
Wagner is a very great storyteller, not only in the way in which he selects aspects of the great myths to tell, because he's also a great poet. You look at the Ring Cycle and what he has culled and the fragments he's woven from the great narrations, the great fables of the gods that he inherited from his tradition.
And the moment you've chosen, actually, is rather relevant to that. It's the entry of the gods into Valhalla, isn't it?
Yes, it's one of the most evocative, one of the most beautiful pieces of music in the Ring Cycle. I happen to have a very profound admiration and love of the Ring Cycle. My discovery of it amounts to a kind of a moment of revelation. And I think it to be maybe one of the five or six great creations of the human spirit in art. And my particular admiration for it is focused on the fact that it is sui generis and that he manages to create a music that was not there before, which expresses the transcendent realm of the gods and the yearnings of the soul.
The gods cross the rainbow bridge into Valhalla from the final scene of Wagner's Das Rheingold, George London singing Wotan, with George Schulte conducting the Vienna Philharmonic. Ben Ockrey, I think you listened to Wagner a lot when you were writing The Famished Road, the book that won the Booker Prize in 1991. And though that is set in your native Nigeria, it does, doesn't it, have echoes of the ancient Norse and Greek stories of the kind that inspired Wagner. Do you see those connections?
Yes, I was looking for a tone. I think the most difficult thing about writing The Famished Road and why it took so long to do was finding a tone. And I listened to many, many pieces of music, from Wagner to Mozart, Beethoven to Miles Davis, to a lot of African music, to Bartok, to Bolero. I listened to a lot of music while writing The Famished Road. And what I was always seeking for was this tone, this musical element, this magical musical element, which without any description, just with the words in the right place, would by themselves conjure up, as it were, in your own mind, a kind of resonance of the world that I have in mind.
And do you think that the legends and the myths that you grew up in a tradition of, do you feel that they, do they inform us about our own condition?
Unmistakably so. These myths tell us about ourselves, because I think the human condition is veiled. We live our lives, we live our stories, and the meaning of what we're living, the meaning of what we're going through is constantly veiled to us. And it's only through dreams and through stories, especially through stories that have endured a long time, distilled by the wisdom of the ages, as it were, that we get to glimpse ourselves in the strange oblique mirror of myths and legends.
One might think, from what you say and the experiences that you've had of that tradition, whether they have an element of the supernatural or the magical in themselves, I don't know, perhaps you'll tell us, but that some people might think, oh, well, are you a magical realist? But in fact, that's not a description that you would apply, is it?
It's not a description I'd apply. I think I've grown weary of trying to bat it away. And now I accept it with a kind of reasonable, resigned tranquility. But I'm fascinated by the intersection between myth and reality. Most of the myths I write about are not just myths in Africa. They actually live in things. They're actually things that people live by and believe. So there's a profound intersection between the legend and the life. And it is that intersection that constantly fascinates me. That's why my work constantly quivers between here and there, between dream and reality.
Another piece of music you listened to, I think, whilst living in London and writing The Famished Road. And this is the opening of Handel's Ode for the Birthday of Queen Anne, Eternal Source of Light Divine. Another tone.
It is another tone, but this time it is a soaring tone. It is a soul-piercing tone. One of the things that drives my writing, and indeed drives my life, is this sense of the vertical lift of the human spirit. And this Handel, this particular section, this Eternal Source of Light Divine, is one of the most soaring and sublime pieces of music I know.
Eternal Source of Light Divine. James Bowman was the soloist in the opening part of Handel's Ode for the Birthday of Queen Anne, with Simon Preston conducting the Academy of Ancient Music. Ben Ockery, you live in London now, and you spent most of your early childhood here as well, but you did move back to Nigeria with your parents when you were 7. And that was a pretty traumatic time, wasn't it?
Well, it was traumatic for a young boy who'd, you know, grown used to London, his friends, and the mood of the Four Seasons, to suddenly be told one morning that you're going back to Nigeria. Mum made this announcement to me one morning, and I think my response was one that startled her. I remember telling her that, very nice. I think you better go on. And I'll stay here. I've got my friends, in which I left behind all my friends without saying goodbye and all of my collection of comics. And I still remember it with a slight, very mild, traumatic shiver.
And if that wasn't bad enough, the Civil War broke out and your family was very much caught up because it came from two different tribes. In fact, you had to hide your mother, didn't you, to protect her?
Yes, a lot of the time. I came close to being shot myself at a roadblock when Mum came to collect me from the West, where I was at school, because I couldn't speak my father's language. I remember that. And afterwards, Mum herself had to be hidden a lot because she belonged to the Igbo tribe. And a lot of time was spent moving her from place to place in small rooms and back rooms, being concealed by very brave and very kind people. And I remember it as being a time in which there was a lot of death around. I saw people being shot, saw kids in the street who had been killed, bodies in the river nearby. It was, I was about seven, and that experience scarred me and set me permanently on the path of questions, asking about, you know, how it is that human beings can be so mean.
And perhaps makes you rejoice even more when you hear creations like Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, which we also know as the Pastoral, because it's such an evocation of the beauties of life.
Somehow threaded through all of this was the presence of music. I cannot remember a time in my life, directly or indirectly, in which music didn't weave its healing, suggestive presence. And this Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony was one I listened to many years after the Civil War, when I was now living in Lagos, living on the edge of the ghetto, because my father's life had at that time taken an unfortunate descent, as it were. It picked up again later on, but that was a poor and difficult period for us. And I remember hearing this often on the radio till I was eventually driven to go buy a copy of my own. But this is the music I associate with two key crossroads in my life, which is the time in which I began writing, the moment in which my soul opened up to the possibility of words, as well as the time in which I began some kind of intellectual, spiritual quest. So this music is very much at the intersection. And I remember maybe the first stories I wrote were written with this music somewhere, the background of my mind.
Thank you. music from the Andante from Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, The Pastoral, Daniel Barenboim conducting the Staatskapelle of Dresden. I wonder what, we've talked about music quite a lot, but I do wonder, Ben, what you were reading when you were young, and did you have access to a lot of literature?
When we went back to Nigeria, one of the things that my father did was he acquired for himself a very comprehensive library of the classics of the world, which he brought back with him to Nigeria with the express purpose of reading his way through them. There's, you know, the intentions are always qualified by reality, and my father, who was a lawyer, was so busy with his many children and his expanding practice and the poor that he was representing that he never got round to reading his books, and they gathered a lot of dust. And it became my duty, as he saw it, and said to me often, Ben, dust those books, because for some reason books in Africa attract a lot of dust, and mysteriously spiders and spiders' webs in there on open pages. I've often wondered how on earth spiders are able to sort of kind of weave their way through those short pages, but for some reason when you open those pages you always find dead spiders and spiders' webs in them. And so Dad told me that my job was to dust the books but not to read them. You begin to ask the question, well, why am I supposed to be dusting these books and not reading them? What are in these books? Are there some magic powers in these books? These questions led me to doing the thing I was not supposed to do. And I read my way through my father's library. I read my way through Dickens, through Jane Austen, through Ibsen, through the short stories of Chekhov, Maupassant, Flaubert, the great Russian writers, the English writers, Shakespeare. It was my accidental discovery and my constant crime.
So it was your secret garden?
It was my secret criminal garden. Let's put it that way, because I was contravening my father's express orders every time I was absorbed in a story or a sentence.
Now a wonderful jazz musician who takes music to the edge, lived his life on the edge, rather, and that was Miles Davis.
Miles Davis, yes, a very iconic figure, and one of the great distillers of jazz, and one of the few musicians who managed to percolate our lives. I don't know how Miles Davis did it. No matter where you were in the remotest parts of Africa, you somehow got to hear Miles Davis. Thank you. Think of that as the music of cities at night.
Miles Davis with Blue in Green from his legendary album Kind of Blue, which was recorded in 1959. Has jazz been a frequent partner in your life, Ben?
Yes, it has been. Jazz has been very, very, very important. I listened to a lot of it. I dreamt of playing it. I discovered quite early that I didn't have any talent for music. And I think my lack of talent for music was compensated for by my great talent for the feeling of music, because I do feel music with the ache of one who was deprived of that faculty. I tried earlier to play the piano and the guitar, and just I think my sensibilities just ran somewhere else in terms of expression, but in terms of feeling. Many years in a place called the Jazz Kitchen in Lagos, we used to a group of young poets and writers used to gather together and read our poetry to jazz, and we listened to a lot of jazz in Lagos. Lagos is a great jazz city. Mm. So yes, and it has continued since. I saw Miles Davis two or three times in concert and went backstage to see him once, and carried away with me the legendary exchange in which he said, "What do you do?" And I said, "I write." And he said, "So you're a writer." It's just the way he said it. "So you're a writer." Even his unique beat was in the way he spoke, soaked into everything he did and the gestures of his hands.
He managed to convey the simplest sentence with a kind of syncopation.
Absolutely.
Your writing also has a very meditative, spiritual quality. And I wonder whether you find that quality in the music we're going to hear next, perhaps the Laudate Dominum from Mozart's Vespers.
Yes, I do. But then, you know, the spiritual for me has always been a very complicated area, because I don't know, people perceive of the spiritual as being out of this world, to do with that which cannot be seen and that which cannot be felt and touched. Whereas for me, the spiritual comes out of our engagement with the richness of reality. It's not an escape from it. And Mozart is for me one of those figures who manages to suggest all the worlds and all the realms in a simple tone or melody. He is for me the effortless angel of the art of the music of the spirit and the body. Oh, what a sublime version.
And it's marvellous the way he manages to make a line at the end just go further and further. The arch just extends, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. A great, great, great breathing of the spirit. But, you know, it's listening to this brings me to something that that has troubled me for some time. A lot of our conversation so far has revolved around music that I listen to while writing. My position on this has changed profoundly, and I now no longer listen to music while I'm writing. I now prefer complete silence, and maybe that's because the music is already in me. But I feel very strongly that it is a crime that we commit against music when we listen to music as the background to our lives, making tea, playing the crossword puzzles, driving, maybe forgivable. But when we treat music as some kind of background balm to existence, listening to that makes me feel that music should be listened to with a complete surrender of the soul as its own purpose, completely. It should dominate totally the stage of one's ears and one's heart. How else can you listen to that?
Another reason, I think, from the point of view of being a musician, is that my brain is constantly listening to and analysing what's going on. And I couldn't do that if I was also trying to do something else. So it's quite interesting. We come from different parts, if you like, but arrive at the same place.
Absolutely.
The Laudate Dominum from Mozart's Solemn Vespers. The soaring soprano was Kirita Kanawa, and Colin Davis was conducting the London Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. And you can find details of all Ben Ochre's music on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Well, now we're going to move south in Africa, Ben, to South Africa, and that extraordinary versatile pianist and composer, Abdullah Ibrahim, famous anti-apartheid campaigner, something which you obviously identify with very closely.
Oh, absolutely. This is the music, one of several, but one that definitely stood out in my mind, that one listened to during that great heroic period when we were all trying, campaigning to end apartheid and to get Nelson Mandela freed. And there are many legends about this piece of music and about Abdullah Ibrahim. One which may or may not be apocryphal is that someone managed to smuggle into Robben Island a moment of Abdullah Ibrahim, and that Mandela actually got to be able to hear it in prison at a time when music was banned in the prison. So I just like the idea that Mandela might have heard this during that difficult period. But there's another thing about this music that fascinates me. And I've always said that there is a very unique, very distinct, immeasurable African tone. And you get a lot of it in this particular piece called Mannenberg.
Mannenberg from Abdullah Ibrahim. Ben Okri, you've just published a new novel, The Age of Magic, about the transforming experiences of a group of filmmakers on a trip to Switzerland. Actually, it's your first novel for 7 years. It has very strong kind of poetical, considered writing in it, which I enjoyed very much. Why did you take that break? Were you just writing other things?
Yes, I was. I was writing poems, brought out a book of poems called Wild last year. Essays, poetic essays, a form that I love very much. And very short pieces, short stories called stokus, which is a form that I devised, which is a mixture, a meeting between the haiku and the short story. So I've been working on these forms. In the background of all of that, this novel had been developing. And if you read it, you will see that it gathers in all of these forms. It's strange the way in which you write a novel and all your different concerns, all the different minute aspects of craft in other genres feed into the novel you write. And so this novel is both a story, but it also has elements of poetry, elements of stoku. And
this is quite pared down, isn't it? Sometimes just a paragraph or two for each chapter. Harper Simon, the American musician, next. Ben, what inspired this choice?
This is a very cute story, actually. Harper Simon is a very good friend, and he would be annoyed with my saying this and delighted at the same time, I think. He's a son of Paul Simon, and he lived in London for a number of years. And while he was here, he said to me one day, "Ben, do you have a poem? I'd like to set it to music." So I gave him a poem called More Fishes Than Stars, but he adapted the title to just Wishes and Stars. He disappeared with the poem for a year, came back, and brought back this extraordinary piece of music.
Themselves, they're brimming with success. Their whole life's been blessed, but it doesn't matter. Everyone's been on holiday and so on. Well, they just got back from one. All they do is just have fun. They all got more friends than they can use. Except me, cause I'm a fool. Simple as a beat, as a melody in C, but it don't matter. There are more wishes than stars. I'm not too certain about many things. I'm not too sure who I am. I ain't got no mother and I ain't got no father. Girlfriend, hold my hand. I'm slow like the trees when they grow. I'm sluggish like the ocean when it moves. I'm plain like water or like rain, but I shouldn't complain, cause it don't matter. Stars.
wishes than stars.
I think that's a little piece of perfection.
Harper Simon's Wishes and Stars, a song with words by my guest Ben Ockrey. It does capture a feeling of loneliness. And is that an autobiographical feeling from that time? I think it was, wasn't it?
Yes, it was very autobiographical. I was going through a kind of very down period, a difficult period. I lost my parents. But writing this poem really, really helped me. It's very strange. It was like saying, OK, this is how things are. Great. Now we can go forward from there. I needed to do it.
And you did. You've been very successful in your career. But I wonder whether that thing of the human spirit always yearning means there are still wishes, things that you still wish for.
I think there are always things that one wishes for. There are things that I haven't done yet that I'd love to do. There are dreams as yet unfulfilled. But I think with the passing of each day and each year, I grow more tranquil in that direction. I think one focuses more on things that you've managed to do well.
Well, I'm going to finish on a note which is going to put you on the spot just to upset your tranquility for one second, Ben Ockrey, because you want the famous Pachelbel canon to play you out, but you're not sure whether to have a Baroque version or some nice, slightly sentimental strings.
Oh, my
goodness. What's it going to be?
Michael, you've loaded it there. I love the Baroque version, but the one you call the sentimental version is one I'm much, much more familiar with, because I associate this music with a kind of a deep thought. And I actually would like people, when they listen to it, to sort of forget all the weddings that you've heard this piece of music at or any adverts. Just listen to it purely for the great spaces of beauty and meditation that's in it. This is a music that the soul loses itself in and finds itself again.
It's like a mantra.
It is like a gorgeous mantra of courage and peace.
Thank you very much, Ben Ockrey, for sharing your private passions with us.
Ah, it has been so delightful. It's been almost a blessing. Thank you.
William Boughton conducting the English String Orchestra in Pachelbel's Canon, bringing that episode of Private Passions to a close. Michael Barclay's guest was the novelist Ben Ockrey. The producer was Jane Greenwood for Loftus. And you can download that programme and many more if you go to the Radio 3 podcast page. Well, next week's guest on the programme is the Welsh poet Gwyneth Lewis. Very good afternoon to you if you've recently tuned in to Radio 3. This is Ian Skelly to guide you through our programmes this afternoon. Plenty of good music to come. We're off to Cuba in an hour from now and back to the 18th and early 19th centuries. Today's early music show reflects on the music making of that time in that part of the world. And with the help of Andrew McGregor, who you may have heard on Radio 3 last week, discovering all about the classical music tradition in that particular part of the world, we'll be discovering how much of that music making survives in the classical music tradition in Havana today. That's at 2 o'clock. The music of Monteverdi, Samuel Barber and the Beach Boys mix in this week's edition of The Choir at 4. And that's followed by our uninterrupted sequence of words and music, which promises to be interesting. If only I could remember what it's about.
There occur moments which you're able to recognise immediately with the naked eye as high spots. Words and music on Radio 3. Something tells you that they're going to remain etched forever on the memory and will come back to you at intervals down the years as you're dropping off to sleep.
Memories, according to P.G. Woodhouse, are like mulligatawny soup in a cheap restaurant. It is best not to stir them.
All this burden of past experience one trails about with one. There ought to be some way of getting rid of one's superfluous memories. How I hate old Proust!
Join us for memory-themed poetry and prose read by Tom Hiddleston and Eleanor Bron. Words and Music at 5:30 this evening and again via the Radio 3 website.
Yes, don't forget. And our lunchtime concert is next. It's in a couple of minutes. Violin sonatas by Bach and Mozart. That's after a summary of the BBC News at 1 o'clock. Both sides in the conflict in eastern Ukraine have agreed to withdraw their heavy weapons from the front line. The Ukrainian military and Russian-backed separatists say they've signed a deal to pull back their artillery, but it's not known when the withdrawal will begin. Officials in Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine say an explosion has killed 3 people during a march in the city centre. Police say the blast was caused by an unknown explosive device and it's being treated as a terrorist attack. The Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott has said he'll consider changes to the legal and immigration systems in response to an official report on the Sydney cafe siege in which 2 hostages were killed. The gunman, an Islamist migrant from Iran, was facing criminal charges at the time. Syrian state television has described an operation by Turkey to move an Ottoman tomb as flagrant aggression. The tomb of Suleiman Shah, the grandfather of the founder of the Ottoman Empire, was besieged by Islamic State fighters. It'll be moved to a new site closer to the Turkish border. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, has said that he wants to introduce a new crime targeting companies which fail to prevent tax evasion. Speaking to the BBC, Mr. Alexander said a tiny minority still behaved as if evading tax was more of a sport than a crime. The leader of UKIP, Nigel Farage, says his party was right to expel a councillor who made comments he condemned as deeply racist. Roseanne Duncan, who now sits as an independent councillor in Kent, made the remarks in a BBC documentary. British actors will be hoping for success at the Oscars in Hollywood later today. Among the hopefuls are Eddie Redmayne for Best Actor in The Theory of Everything, along with Benedict Cumberbatch for The Imitation Game. Felicity Jones and Rosamund Pike are nominated for Best Actress. The weather, rain, some of it heavy, will spread to all areas by this evening. There'll be some snow across northern hills and gales in the west. Tonight, more rain, but it will clear by the early hours and it will feel cold overnight. And that's the news and the weather. Time now on Radio 3 for our lunchtime concert. And a second chance to hear last Monday's live broadcast here on Radio 3 from Wigmore Hall in London. It's introduced by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to the Radio 3 lunchtime concert here at Wigmore Hall for a recital of Bach and Mozart by 2 terrific musicians. Giuliana Carmagnola, one of the great Italian violinists who specialises in early repertoire and is well known for his collaborations with the Venice Baroque Orchestra. And joining him, the South African keyboardist Christian Bezuidenhout, who's playing a copy of an 1805 fortepiano today for the whole programme. They're going to end with a Mozart sonata, and before that, a pair of sonatas from the set of six by Bach. The interesting thing about these pieces is that when we talk about violin sonatas, nowadays we tend to think of them as the violin having the melody and the piano simply being an accompaniment. But actually, the relationship between the two has been far more fluid over the years. It's actually much later development, with the violin being the star. In Mozart's day, the violin was the one that was thought of as an accompanying instrument. In the two Bach sonatas they're going to start with, the parts are pretty much equal. You can really hear the counterpoint between the two. Bach will start off a theme in the keyboard's right hand, and then it'll be echoed in the violin, or the other way round. The first one they're going to play is the second of Bach's six violin sonatas. It's in A major and in four movements. The second and fourth are lively, the third an andante, which means at a walking pace with a walking bass line, and the first is marked dolce, to be played sweetly. And the door for the stage of Wigmore Hall opens. Here come the violinist Giuliano Carmignola and fortepianist Christian Bezuidenhout for the first of two Bach violin sonatas, this one in A major.
Thank you. Thank you.